Good. All right, so John, what I'd like to do, what I discussed with Eddie, would be a kind of a political background, life, events, interesting things from your perspective, what brought you towards green anarchism. Like when I think about my own background, I think about different stages, and it's always easy to read back from now and say, oh, development. But one can also step back and say, well, that was, you know, opportunistic. That was an error. I wasn't, you know, I can say that also about myself. You know, people like, for instance, like an extreme example, Dmitry Roussopoulos, who was always at the right place at the right time, and the evolution was always in the correct current. And I, you know, I don't make those pretensions personally. And I think Eddie mentioned that you had once been a Maoist or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So, you know, that'd be probably one of the most unauthoritarian or anti-authoritarian Maoist.
Oh, I didn't know what was going on, though. I mean, I was just attracted by the militancy. This was 66, 67, somewhere in there, and things were starting to really take off in San Francisco and Berkeley.
What were the Maoists then? What was it, a party that...
Progressive Labor, later took over SDS in the U.S. and was, you know, an awful Marxist-Leninist sect, which was... But
Maoists at the time weren't the New Left, though, in the U.S. Did they consider themselves part of that New Left or not?
Well, I don't think they did, but some people did. You know, for example, the split between the CP and PL, I mean, the Moscow-oriented communists and the Mao and the China-oriented Communist Party, which was Progressive Labor Party. I mean, I think that's a little strange, but I mean, I think, because I remember it, some people thought that is the new left, because it shifts away from the very conciliatory policies of the Soviet Union at the time. They didn't want any real radical stuff anywhere in the world, as you know.
Does that coincide a little bit with the break that was taking place, would you say, between Euro-communism and Moscow-oriented communism, or is that a separate phenomenon that wouldn't have been parallel and going on in the same period of time?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not sure. That might have been different.
Because I don't know when the Euro-communist type of, you know, split and differentiation from Moscow took place, but that was also probably earlier than that, even in the 50s, maybe?
I think that's right. I think that's right. Togliatti in Italy and...
The most interesting developments were in Italy, vis-a-vis what communists were doing when they were breaking away from the parties and the you know, Moscow and all that, I would imagine. More so than,
I guess you're right. I don't know.
Theoretically and all that.
In the U.S., there wasn't much. There wasn't much awareness of that, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking. You were 20 years old in 1962. Is that right?
63.
Right. When did you start becoming politically aware, active in anything that could be described as dissenting or liberal or whatever? Or did you come from a liberal background?
No, a conservative Catholic background.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Well, speaking of being 20, I was in Italy when I was 20, and that was the first time I really noticed anything. It was the time when the Birmingham bombing, killing the black children there in Birmingham, Alabama.
Yeah.
And that was that made a big impact on me. That was 63.
You heard about that in Italy?
Yeah.
What were you doing in Italy at the time?
Well, it was this Stanford in Italy two terms thing in the spring and summer of 63.
You were studying what at the time?
I was 19 and 20 in that period. Oh, well, it wasn't much of a program. It was really kind of just a party. I mean, we'd go into the Uffizi, and some of us would go out the side door to the nearest bar. I mean, I can't say I learned very much, but I was reading L'Unità every day to learn Italian. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know why I picked L'Unità, the Communist Party, daily.
Sure.
But I was absorbing stuff, even though I didn't really know what... much about communism whatsoever. Maybe I thought it was kind of shocking or something to read that, but I wasn't political. And you know, I remember a little a little tableau, or what is the word? I was hitchhiking around in Italy during that period, and I remember this very clearly. It had a big impact on me in almost a religious sense. I was walking around in Naples in, in a fairly poor neighborhood, I think, and I came across this Communist Party neighborhood headquarters or office of some kind, and the door was open, and it was dark, and it was this poor neighborhood, and there was an old guy in there with a young boy teaching him, reading Marx to him. And there was something really touching about it, and I still didn't know anything about Marx or anything.
Right.
But it was just it seemed like there was really something there somehow. I can't even describe it, but it was, I remember it very vividly.
That reminds me of a film that was set in Italy about, who was it, the Chilean poet, what's his name?
Neruda,
who was in exile in Italy, and he sees, this very kind of primary communism and this sort of sympathies that people have with each other, the communists, and how they form this like parallel society, not necessarily better, but having their own ethos among themselves.
Mm.
Yeah, and I'm sure it had more roots, these types of mentalities, these parallel social outlooks. You could be a conservative within it, you could be an authoritarian personality within it, just like you could be with mainstream society. That's why these things, probably never really took off in terms of major social critiques.
Yeah, I think I sense something of that connection or community or something.
So after, your studies in Italy or your party in Italy, what did you do?
Well,
you
came back to Stanford. I mean, I dropped out for a while, but I came back there, and I never was comfortable at Stanford. Very rich kids, mostly, and with sports cars and everything, and I didn't have any money. And for whatever reasons,
Whose choice was it to go to Stanford?
My parents didn't know anything about colleges. It was just kind of a random, lucky thing, because I got a scholarship to go there, and here were all these kids from prep schools, and I thought, I'd flunk out right away, because I don't know who they're talking about. They'd be talking about Camus late at night, and Camus? I never heard of Camus, Anyway, but I rapidly learned I'm not going to flunk out. It's not that big a deal, And then I became disillusioned with it all, shit, this is nothing, this is no big deal, it's not such a big privilege after all. I was more hanging out or living with people that were the few radicals, and then also the few people at that time that were taking LSD or smoking weed, it was a very conservative campus.
This is all the post-Beat, I'd imagine.
Yeah, post-Beat. They're just too late. I went up to North Beach in San Francisco, and all the Beatnik places were closing.
Yeah.
But in a short time, the free speech movement in 64 in Berkeley was exploding. And at the time, I wished I'd gone to UC Berkeley, but I didn't know what to choose or where to go or anything. And we used to go there on the weekends all the time, anything to get away from Stanford. So it was, fortunately, it was nearby. It's not that far from the other side of the bay.
Yeah.
And I was right there in the middle of the beginning of the anti-war movement and all that stuff, just because I happened to be physically looking, geographically there. And it would open my eyes pretty quickly by the luck of being there. I was still a Catholic, though, when I was 19.
You were a practicing Catholic?
I was.
Really? I see.
Yeah, and then that just evaporated.
Like a kind of a mainstream American conservative Catholicism or some particular on it?
Not liberation theology. No, I didn't know anything about that. Just a regular Catholic, fairly devout even to some degree.
So the Catholicism, both of your parents were from Bohemia or one of them?
No, that's further back, 19th century.
Were they Protestant Bohemians, or were they Catholic?
They were all Catholic.
I see. Okay.
So it goes, both sides of the family go back.
No Taborites in the family?
No, I guess not. It was very not. I wonder what they thought of that. Well, he probably didn't even know about it.
No.
I don't know.
These things had been so thoroughly suppressed, I imagine, by that time, by the late 19th century. So, So we're now what, in the mid-60s?
Mid-60s.
What were you doing
at that stage? The thing that kind of grounded my thinking or turned me toward anarchism, or anarchy, maybe it was a better word, is in 66 I graduated after some problems, you know, dropping out once and then having a few problems. But anyway, I graduated in 66 and I worked in an oil refinery for a while and I didn't know what to do. But what I ended up doing is working for about 4 years for the city and county of San Francisco, the Department of Social Services, the welfare department.
Right.
I was a welfare caseworker.
That was the time you developed your union activism.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And the most incredible thing happened the first month I was there. There was a guy who was retiring. His name is Donnelly. I still remember what he looks like. And he was leaving, an old guy, lifers we'd call them, you know, they spend their whole lives in there. Hard to get them to do anything radical. You know, they weren't interested. They just wanted the security of the job and all that. But he was a nice old guy. Anyway, he was retiring on a Friday. At 10 minutes to 5 on Friday, they fired him. So they wouldn't have to pay the pension.
Holy mackerel.
You
could do things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man.
And there was a union. In fact, it was an SEI union, Services Employees International.
Okay.
Which right now is thought of as quite, progressive. You know, they organize lower paid workers, service workers. That's what they did back then. And I remember the union there, Local 400 of SEIU. I mean, everybody was just flipping out. You can't do that. Look at this nice old guy. You're sacking him at 10 minutes to 5, you know, for no reason, just because, I mean, no reason. It was unbelievable.
This was a way of just avoiding paying him a pension, or was it also because they didn't even like his type of activism?
Oh, he wasn't an activist at all. He was just a quiet old guy.
Union bureaucrat, right?
No, Donnelly was just a caseworker.
Oh, okay.
He was just a caseworker. He had nothing to do with anything. And there wasn't anything going on. But if he'd been on the job at close of business at the end of that week, in other words, 10 more minutes, it was that incredible, that blatant. So everybody was just completely flipped out. And a lot of people who had no interest in any unions, not even unions, much less the radical thing that was beginning to become huge in the Bay Area by that time already, quite big and getting much bigger. Everybody went to the union and said, look, you gotta, and things went through civil service, the Civil Service Commission, because we were all public workers. That's the way it worked, in other words, through City Hall. And they basically said, oh, nothing we can do. And people just went, wait a minute, that's not quite good enough. Nothing you can do? What a rotten, corrupt, do-nothing union, and this is unbelievable. And so there was no choice but to form our own union, just a do-it-yourself union. And because a lot of the people were like me, didn't know where else to go to get a job, didn't want to work for an insurance company, or didn't have any particular, you know, direction or anything, you could, with a college degree, you could go there and get a job. And they were expanding. The welfare thing was expanding. The whole thing was growing. So they needed more people, no matter how crazy they were. Or who, you know, they didn't really care. They were hiring people hand over fist. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we started that union, and because we were often nonconformist or whatever, it had features like. Almost immediately we decided we didn't want to have any paid staff, any paid organizers or officers. We didn't want to ever sign a contract. And there were all these kind of, I don't know if you'd call it anarchists, but it seemed to me kind of anarchist, or at least syndicalist. Although nobody ever used that word.
Were people aware of the IWW and things like that? Was it modeled on those lines?
No, it wasn't.
What was
it
the experience of people, syndicalism?
None. Really? I'd say none. I never heard it in 4 years. I never heard any mention. Well, somebody might have mentioned it, but there was no reason to go to the IWW. I mean, anyway, because we did, sure. Reformed it, yeah. And started getting dues, and even that changed pretty quickly to whatever you want to pay. And even sort of later, you could if you wanted to be some kind of officer, you could make up your own office. You know, in other words, it was completely unstructured, you know, but there was a lot of juice. There was a lot of, and there were a lot of really amazing organizers. I think we still use the word organizers, but there were some people that didn't want to ask anyone to join. They were so anarchic, I guess you'd say, is we don't call it a union. We don't want to ask people to pay dues. And I wasn't quite that extreme. I thought, well, we got to have dues.
You know, how many members? How many active people? How many just people passively paid memberships?
Oh, most of it was people knew that the wild, this is the wild bunch that made things happen.
Right.
But the biggest...
That included you then?
Yeah, it did rapidly. Okay. I just started breathing that in and digging it. You know, I thought this is great. Well, I think there was less than 300 members at the height of it, which is probably 68, early 68.
And how did the employer find that? Like, well, how did they deal with it?
They wanted us to sign a contract.
Yeah.
And you'd think, why would they want to sign a contract with this crazy bunch of people? I mean, but that would, you know, as usual, unionism stabilizes things.
Yeah.
And then but we didn't want to sign anything. We wanted to, if we won something, then the very next day we'd start out again, pushing it further. And they hated that. You know, well,
I'm
wait
sure.
a minute, you just agreed to this. Or we didn't actually agree to it, we got it, but we were never satisfied. And the whole theory was this kind of workerist theory that you could destabilize everything from within. And in fact, you couldn't destabilize anything from outside.
Mm.
So my attitude for a while was, we kind of laughed at people who were in the streets. You don't have any leverage. You're just making noise in the street. That does nothing. You know, I felt that very strongly for a while. That was what I operated under. You can't bring down the system if you're outside somewhere. You've got to be a worker. And so in a way, it was like the workers.
But concretely, how did that type of union and its relationship to the employer, how did it affect like work performance? Was this a monkey wrenching kind of union? Was this the kind of union that even a boss would be able to stand because it's better than no union?
I think
probably
because
not.
The other union was still there. Local 400 was
right.
The other choice.
Right.
And I mean, they were always trying to fire people, fire organizers, at least for a while.
Right.
And claim that all they were doing is making trouble, and they weren't. But actually, the organizers didn't have much trouble being competent caseworkers, for that matter. And competent meaning to ally with the what we call clients, with the poor people, in league against City Hall, against the what they were going to give out to people. For example, we would go right up together to the top floor and just go right in and say, look, you know, got to have more money here. Or whatever it was, you know, and they hated that because that wasn't the way you did it. You were just supposed to be, you know, you were a cop. And a lot of people treated welfare workers exactly as cops for the obvious reason. That's what we were. But we were trying to change that. You know, we had the illusion that somehow we could be allies with them. And that was really an illusion. I mean, that wasn't going to go very far. But it was really... Things were very, you know, things were everywhere. Things were being challenged, and that was just another way they were being challenged.
So.
And in a way, you're right, though, in a way, though, because in a certain sense, they wanted the stability, perhaps, of even our union. Maybe they did, because we had one program was called General Assistance, and it was just people, it was county money, and you didn't have to go through a whole lot of paperwork. And there would be people like flooding the ground where that office was usually on the first floor of these buildings. And the workers, it was so chaotic. It reminded me of Henry Miller, that transatlantic cable thing where everybody's running, papers are flying. There was a guy in there who was on LSD most of the time, and he wore this cape, and he was just a madman. And if we had organized him, he would have been less of a madman. You know what I mean? It would have been more stable. Than it was.
That's
it was
right.
Just crazy.
Yeah,
you just right. Didn't even want to go in there. It was like a riot every day almost, you know, in a way. And so we just thought, well, we're going to leave this alone, you know, let them do whatever they want, and we'll try our other approach, you know, somewhere else in the other programs.
So that took you to what led you to drop that, or what circumstances got you to move away from that type of work or that sort of?
Well, two things. I began. Yeah. I was writing more and more about unionism.
Yeah.
And because we had our biggest enemies was organized labor. They hated us even more than City Hall did. You know. Even more than...
Like the more mainstream unions.
Yeah, Vocal 400, SEIU, and all these other rotten unions. And they were corrupt and dangerous, you know, but we just made fun of them and didn't want to have anything to
these
do with
them. These were like mob-dominated, or
somewhere.
There were real rackets that
there were... One or two were, like
were
the
really
operating
pacifying
engineers.
And then mediating between employer and the workers in a very blatant way, I imagine.
Yeah, and even fights would break out sometimes. And, you know, it gets a little, you know...
Wow.
These unions don't play. I mean, they...
That's right.
You could get hurt. You could, you know, you could get killed. I mean, it didn't go that far or anything, but... Well, the other thing is, I mean, besides writing, I was writing more and more. And I just decided, I'm not even doing this job. I'm doing enough to keep the job, but in fact, I'm almost not a union organizer. I was writing all this stuff about these studies, if you will, about how unions operate. Public employees unions. There were phony strikes, for example, that we didn't support. It was very strange. There were strikes that we didn't go out. We didn't go out, and of course they were horrified, called the scabs, but they were phony strikes. They were absolutely phony. As a lot of these people, I think NEFAC probably doesn't even know this, how many strikes are absolutely phony. They're just all set up to let off steam. There's nothing at stake. There's nothing, you know, not even the demands. I mean, they would get less.
Why did they do them? Why did they
just let off steam?
To let off steam.
Oh, we're militant. We're gonna strike, and they'd have a strike on Friday. It'd be settled over the weekend. People would be back on Monday. It's just a fucking joke.
Is this a way of legitimizing the union leadership at the base?
Exactly. We are powerful.
We're active. We're doing stuff for you.
Yeah.
Come out to this,
we're on
this
strike. And it was bullshit.
Wow.
We saw right through it. So we'd write about that. But the other thing was, I think more profoundly was, what is an organizer? And I came to the conclusion, and talking about myself just as much as anyone else, mainly it's you're trying to get people, you're trying to activate people, but you're not telling them the whole deal. You know, like if I would try to sign somebody up or show them how to pursue grievances our style or whatever, I didn't tell them the whole thing, that this is our theory, we're gonna start shaking the foundations of this stuff from within.
So what would be
falls.
The what would be the whole deal?
Well, that would be the whole deal. But I didn't tell them that.
You don't tell them that. I see.
You know, most.
Would they found that laughable anyway, or not?
Well, they credible? Might not have cared. You know, they'd sign up anyway. Well, whatever. You know, but some people wouldn't have. They'd say, "Oh,
wow.
Well, gee, so you got this bigger aim and stuff, and I don't like that." You know, so
So you guys would have been concerned that the people you're signing up would have been not as radical in outlook and would have been scared off.
Right. Although I think some people were more transparent.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just a generalization to say that, but I just felt like I know how to be an organizer. I helped write a grievance manual of our type of approach, you know, kind of goofy approach. But I'm not being honest with the thing. I'd rather put the whole thing on the table.
What you're doing is building a constituency.
That's right. And I mean, we chose to not quite look at it that way, but that's really what it was. I mean, it's... In some ways, we made it pretty clear. I mean, we weren't playing the game, but we kind of were playing the game. You know, that was a whole debate about whether it's a union. And my approach was, yeah, it's a union, but a whole lot more than a union. I don't care if you call it a union. So, you know, you said, well, then what are you really doing? You know.
So what was the name of this union again?
Oh, KSI. Social Services Employees Union. It had a total standard name, and we never dropped the name. But that's what we started as, just SSEU. There's nothing radical about the name.
Yeah. So you were writing increasingly at that time, mostly about union activism and syndicalism?
Well, not so much syndicalism, just what is the institution called unionism, and historically. And the more historical part, that's what took me out of the picture altogether, into the question of industrialism and the discipline of the factories and all that stuff like that. And then,
did a lot of those writings ever wind up in essay form? Like, I'm sure they influenced... Is there one or two things that you wrote on your union days?
Oh, just one about my personal experience.
Right.
But there were some articles that were in the journal Telos.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's how I met Freddie Perlman.
Great.
He read the I think it was called Organized Labor Versus the Revolt Against Work.
Right.
You know, and it was more anti-work than it was, certainly more than it was...
Was he one of the first big contacts, like in terms of, you know, radical thinkers at the time and people publishing and people doing stuff, or did you, had you met other influences that would influence you later in the same way that...
He was a real important early one.
Yeah.
And I had never heard of Fifth Estate. He told me about Fifth Estate.
Right.
He said you ought to get in touch with him, maybe you could send him stuff, and I did, and right away that connected... But I didn't know anything.
So you quickly did get in touch with Fifth to say we're working with them. And this was when?
This was 75.
75. What had happened in the intervening time? You were. It was a quiet period between the late 60s.
Oh, graduate school. The big disaster.
Okay.
You know, I didn't want to work. So, and I wanted a place where I could do my work. And that was a pretty mediocre school. This wasn't Stanford where they would bother you more.
This was where?
Well, first San Francisco State for the MA, and then. And then USC. I was in LA for 3 years in the 70s. And I just thought, well, they would leave me alone. I can do a lot of research and beats working. And that's what I did.
So you weren't actually an organizer or active necessarily or in contact with other radicals at the time?
Well, no, but I was. What I had discovered in the early 70s was the situationist stuff.
Okay.
And that was a big influence.
Yeah.
That was a big. And that was before I met Freddie.
Did you follow May 68 in France and it's very you followed it closely.
I was still working in the social services in San Francisco at the time.
Okay, right.
And that was the same time as the 68 convention in Chicago, you know, Democratic Party convention.
So all the situationist stuff quickly got translated into various languages, English included, by the early 70s?
Well, yeah, but that was the problem. In the Bay Area, everything was over by the early 70s.
Yeah,
and it just really struck me as tragic that it didn't get to the west coast of the U.S. until, like, 70. And it was over by then. And it's the same thing, in a lot of ways, with the women's movement. That didn't come in time to deepen the thing or make it much more...
What do you mean by over? Like, we know, but we heard about the 70s, how that was like the me generation, all this, you know, these kind of glib things that are said about it. But what for you meant that it was over?
Well, I think it's just that in Berkeley and in San Francisco, things started earlier and they ran their course.
That's right.
The other places, say in the U.S., other places hadn't even hardly gotten going with anything, and it was dead.
Yeah.
It was dead in 69. It was amazing. It's like the Haight-Ashbury was dead before most people even heard about it. You know, the big years were 64, 65, 66. I lived there in 66, and by 67, it was going downhill. And you know, most people, what is Haight-Ashbury? What do you mean by that? And then it was like a big...
So the roots of the counterculture had been established in California. It did its flowering. And then by then, the seeds, I guess, scattered to other parts of North America in terms of its impact.
Yeah, if that's the way it works. I don't know. Maybe that's the way it works.
I don't know. Maybe that's not.
But
the
you know that I remember the Altamont thing, the Rolling Stones concert in December of '69, which was really awful. You know, that guy got killed there, and the weather was awful. It was just like a. It was almost like a. I don't know what you call like a death service or something. You know, and. You know, things were done by then. Things were just done. And that's when you had groups like Weather and SLA starting from then. They just could not accept that it was over. And it was. You know, so what do you have left? Well, you can always pick up the gun. You always got one more card to play.
Right.
If you're desperate enough to do it, or whatever the word is, you can go that way. But I think they all knew they weren't going to kickstart the big movement of the 60s again. Maybe they thought so, but nobody else did, I don't think. They didn't. I think it was just strictly a matter of, we can't accept it. We can't accept it. We're going to go on the attack anyway. And they thought that maybe the prison movement was going to be what would take over from the failure of the rest of it, or I don't know. But in that place, in the Bay Area, where there's a lot of so much stuff that was pretty interesting, you know, and of course the Black Panthers in Oakland and all that, you knew it wasn't going to just go away with no aftershocks or whatever. There's going to be something going on. And we heard about SLA before it even started, that there's this heavy group forming in Berkeley, you know, that kind of thing, or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. Or like another one was the Attica thing in 71, which is also the 100-year anniversary of the Commune.
Right.
And some cops got killed that day. I mean, that week or whatever, because there were people who were still, well, Black Liberation Army, you know, all that
stuff.
It's
like a very appropriate way of celebrating the commune.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody poked a shotgun in the door of one police station out by San Francisco State, and a cop came to see what was and got blown away.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Not a lot of it, but
part of the job.
There were people there that were just still very fierce, you know, even though the movement had stopped. You couldn't get anyone to go to any meeting or anything, but no big, you know, widespread stuff. It was the steam had gone out of it totally. It was a funny feeling, you know, to realize, well, that's the ball game. Wow. That was exciting, but shit, you know, what?
I think these are things that are, you experience them periodically because, I mean, I think there was the same feeling after 9/11, after all the energy that we saw around the, you know, the anti-globalization things, Genoa, Seattle, Quebec City. And there was that same feeling that the steam had just gone from that. Of course, I never really thought that these things were going to go very far other than just being big, mega, you know, showdowns.
Well, I could be wrong, but I see that a little differently. It didn't seem like, because I thought the other stuff was really the politics of desperation.
Which other stuff?
At the end of the 60s or the beginning of the 70s.
Really? Yeah.
Not that I didn't respect the people who were willing to go all the way with it. I mean, that was pretty awesome. And, yeah, on that other level, you'd say.
You're talking about what? Weather underground and all that?
Yeah, and weather wasn't so much in California. It was more, SLA was a big thing there.
Sure.
And that's who I saw last weekend, my friend Joe Romero, who's been in prison since the first week of 74. And he's never going to walk out. That's never going to happen for him, I don't think. That's what, 34 years already he's been locked up. And he was an SLA guy from Vietnam.
Right.
Anyway.
So,
I mean, I just see it as a little different. Maybe I need to see it a little differently. I don't know. Maybe that's... But I think this wave of it hasn't really started. It's not like it was finished off after a few years of whatever it was. And I could be wrong, but I feel like it's still there. The energy is still there. That's my feel, anyway. You know, there's still the
vis-a-vis juice. What?
Well, in other words, what happened in Seattle or so forth is...
Yeah.
For example, you wouldn't have these things popping up with book fairs and info shops and what, you know, lots of different things. If there was a movement and then it's all over, well, nobody.
So you
would
feel that there is this libertarian, this anarchist cultural ferment that is just below the surface and is quite active in a way that much more so. Well, I know much more so than in the 1980s, certainly in Montreal. I can't speak for elsewhere. I imagine it would be the case in the case of London, San Francisco, too, and other places.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I guess I do feel like there's still... We haven't gotten started with this one yet.
So, in the 70s, you were, at that point, what? You were reading Situationist stuff. Would you say that had an influence in what you were doing? Like, it had on a great number of people, of course.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, in what ways? I mean, obviously, a lot of people moved away from that. The Situationists were glorifying technology, organization.
Yeah.
They were extremely sectarian in terms of infighting as well. So what?
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Wow. And some of them are absolutely stuck at that same place, like Ken Nabb.
Right.
Some other ones. Billy Brown, you know, in the States. They won't, they haven't questioned some of these things. And right away, my friends and I, the thing of it is, that it was the contradiction that seemed to be so, so clear between, say, in a way, not fully, but in a way between Benegum and Debord.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got the workers' councils, you know, the Hegelian Marxist Debord, to be generalizing about it, and Benegum was much more stressing play and so forth.
Yeah.
Although he towed the party line too about workers' councils, but he almost never mentioned it. Almost never. Only when he was forced to. So how do you have workers' councils versus play? I mean, how do you... You can't... I mean, where's the fun in production? What are you talking about? I mean, and when I would bring that up, they just... Then you could see that they were really more Marxist than not, you know. In fact, you saw that in 68, you know, they put out these Long Live Revolutionary Marxism was one of their dispatches to the people or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, they said it. I mean,
so did you at the time, as a radical, have any type of intersection with them or engagement?
Yeah.
With what? With Americans or with France?
Americans.
Yeah.
Although some French visited.
Yeah.
And it's funny, the part of it that was that I think was valid. In San Francisco, I was at the end of my days in the social services, and was starting to change my thinking on that. I was president of the union at one point in there before we even abolished president.
But weren't these titles all just made up as you went along?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
They didn't mean anything except that I had to often chair meetings and people would
right.
be
Right, yeah, that is a real
nuts.
Role.
You know,
that
I had
is
to go
a
to
real
the bar
role.
First
yeah.
and throw down a couple of things. Because when I ran for it, we were still having kind of standard elections.
Yeah.
The former president was kind of weak. He wasn't ready for the craziness of the time. And so I ran, and I was... And then I thought, oh, damn, now I got to do something more than I was doing. But at one time, the Ken Nabb and one of his groups put out this big poster. It was all attacking the... I was called the anti-bureaucrat of the Social Service Employees Union. And they came in and put it on the wall of our union office and everything and made a big drama out of it.
This was a critique of
yeah.
your practices?
And it was fairly valid in some ways,
yeah.
you know, that they... They
but said, what, from what perspective was he coming from at the time?
Basic situationist stuff, that this is, it's a reformist illusion. I don't know if they spelled all this out. Maybe they, but they said it's pretty tame, you know, and these people, Zerzan, you know, they think that you can pull down the thing from within, started wobbling and have everybody fighting all the time. You know, everybody's filing a grievance, everybody's challenging everything. And finally, it can't even operate. And the policies are being ignored. And you know, you start to have problems. That was what we were trying to do.
It can't even operate. Like, what do they want to have operating?
Well, that was us.
Yeah,
that was us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was fiction. I mean, it was
sure.
just we were thinking that, but that wasn't going to happen.
Uh-huh.
And I think they said something along those lines that...
So you know Ken Nabb from way back.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't even know where, you know, I'm ignorant of as to when he was starting his
Oh, he was one of the first people to get the virus from France.
Okay,
and
I see. Okay.
Yeah, he was very... Okay. He's written some very interesting stuff,
Absolutely. I have read some of his stuff and appreciate some of it.
But he put out this book a couple of years ago, two or three years ago, called The Joy of Revolution. It's all this Sid stuff.
Yeah.
And at the San Francisco Book Fair, he was tabling and he made this sign that said, "This is the book that Zerzan doesn't want you to read." And I went, gee, you know, I mean, I reviewed it somewhat negatively. Basically, I said he's still stuck in 1971.
Yeah, I saw some of your reviews of it.
It was a negative review, but I mean, it's not that I don't want people to read it. I mean, I'm not afraid of people reading it. But you know, afterwards, when everybody was leaving, we were taking this stuff out and heading toward this one door, we found ourselves walking out together, and he gave me this big smile and put out his hand, so I shook his hand, you know. So he's not a jerk, you know.
No, okay. That's good.
He's very serious about it. If you're not a situationist, you're really shit, basically, you know, but still, he's not a horrible guy. Individually, I guess.
So at this stage, we're what? We're in the mid-70s, is that right? And you're still where?
Well, yeah, that's when I started really getting into the whole industrialism technology thing.
Yeah. So the whole ecologism or green side of things came from industrialism technology, which came out of labor activism? What?
Yeah, out of that labor experience.
Wow.
It wasn't very green or eco.
No, I'm sure.
It was more about the social control of industrial technology. It wasn't just an economic thing. It's how do you herd these people into factories? Because they're rioting all the time in England, you know.
Yeah.
That was, I never thought of it that way, but, you know, I was doing all this reading. There's even a little in, you know, Marx even talks about that.
Absolutely.
He's not... you know, super fond of it because he wants everybody to ultimately be in the factories, or not ultimately.
Before I forget to ask, what role at this stage was critical theory and Adorno playing in your thinking, and did this come later that was more relevant, and what would be its relevance now also?
Well, it came about that time,
yeah.
Especially Adorno. I've always had this thing for Adorno, even though he doesn't, there's certainly disagreements, but I always just was, I really took a lot of inspiration from just his style. it just in a sentence, it could just drive right through to the heart of something. I thought, wow, if you could do that, that would be the way to do it. You know, just like a diamond drill right through the, you know, just not a bunch of rhetoric, but I was very impressed. And then then the other thing, really the only other part of it actually, was the total accidental discovery of all the anthropology in the early 80s.
An accidental discovery?
Absolutely. I wasn't writing about that at all.
How's that then? How did that come about?
Well, it was something about... I remember thinking about the quote from Adorno and Horkheimer, every reification is a forgetting. And I was trying to figure out, what does that mean? What is forgetting what? You know, what is... And that's really kind of led to that. And I'm not even sure they meant it that way, like in terms of origins or prehistory. I don't think they were talking about that. But that's kind of led me into that. And I just started slowly. And then when I discovered the whole thing, wow, I didn't know any of this stuff. I didn't know there'd been this huge change of... I never had taken one anthropology course. I remember it was a very weak, small department at Stanford. It was one of the few places that didn't have big name people and everything, and nobody took anthropology. Nor was I interested. What relevance is it? Who cares?
Right. Yeah, you didn't see the relevance for what you were doing.
No, I was just strictly, you know, modern stuff.
So in the 70s, there's no contact or knowledge of people like Murray Bookchin, writings of people like Rachel Carson. These were relevant. These were on the margins.
I was aware of it, but it didn't have much impact for me.
No resonance with where you were at that stage.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, in the U.S., maybe it's the same in Canada, it's a big country, and strangely enough, even though it's so high tech, certainly was already, there's not much contact.
Yeah, that's
you
right.
know, and yeah. So the West was always much more green, probably for the simple reason it's much more green to defend.
It's a bit like a lot of the things that Anne Hansen and the Vancouver Five were doing, and these were very exciting things going on back then. And I don't think that there would have been much in the way of, I mind you, that's a bit before my time, but in contact with people in Toronto or Montreal. I think where things were at was in Vancouver mm-hmm. at the time, in British Columbia.
And another thing, no interest or no connection with the Indigenous traditions and the surviving Indigenous struggles.
They had, though. Didn't they have some critique coming from that?
I think they did, and that was
on the West Coast. There was that. I can't speak for where you were working and what was.
Well, in California, there really you didn't have. I don't think there. Yeah. You know, really, in terms of different groups that I know about a little now, there were not. It was more in the Northwest. But I was very slow to get that. But the anthropology thing leads right into it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they were surviving, gather 100 peoples, of course. And then it dawns on you, and right here where you live, right in North America, duh, you know. So it was, yeah, that was just completely accidental.
So what were the first anthropologists that you were reading? And
Solons.
Yeah.
Solons, which I think still really holds up. He's...
So that fed into the
whole
kind of anti-industrial technology critiques. By then, you'd read Illu, you'd picked up Illu, Mumford, the, you know, the classics.
Oh, not even at that time, nor Heidegger either. I wasn't even aware of Heidegger or any of the anti-tech stuff that was just anti-tech in one way or another.
And you were still involved with Fifth Estate at that point? Were they talking about any of this stuff?
Oh, in the 80s, that was the thing. That was the thing. A little bit like Telos, too, the theory journal Telos. It was kind of a conduit to North America from other countries, you know, translating stuff. And all through the 80s, that's what was exciting about Fifth Estate. And the pieces I wrote about origins, you know, in terms of time and language, number, art and agriculture, I think were the five. Yeah. They were the only ones that would publish those. By that time, I had burned my bridges with Telos. They were not going to touch that. This is wacko stuff. You know what? You know, this, no way. That was. It's one thing to critique unions, you know, but you're still.
What were they doing? Where had they moved to, or what had they? What were they doing at that stage?
Telos?
When you were.
Oh well, the same stuff. I mean, in other words, they weren't going to go into an anthropological thing or.
Okay.
The only kind of, quote, third worldist stuff that they talked about ever was the kind of turgid anti-imperialist leftist stuff, that, and that has no, you know, what do you learn about people living there? Nothing. I mean, they just, you know what I mean? That's a...
Just development in another part of the world. Struggles and development in another part of the world rather than...
And NLF stuff where you want to have, you want to get to the nation stage as soon as you can and modernize. It's not exactly a critique of it. So
I remember I was involved in the 80s. Among my first activism here would have been with things like the... what was going on in El Salvador and Guatemala, you know, national liberation movements. And I wasn't particularly heavily involved, but that's where I saw, you know, where good solidarity work could be done, you know.
Well, that was a very interesting case in point in the late 70s. That started, and that wasn't another source of that, because I was in San Francisco after LA. I came back to San Francisco in the middle 70s, late 70s, and the people there, the ultra-left people, were just pro-Sandinistas.
There you
go. People like Ward Churchill was saying, well, what about the Mosquito people?
That's
what about, you're just sacrificing these people to industrialize.
That's it.
I mean, and that was new to me.
Yeah, I'm sure the FMLN had its sins, too, in that domain, you know, vis-a-vis.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's you know, that's a general statement, but that was also news to me. Like, there's a very different way to look at this, which is the more radical, you know. Mm-hmm. So, where I live, those people were always around, and I was really sore at them. And that was the period of my awful drinking period when I was just really so alienated from everyone.
In the late 70s?
Yeah, 70s. I was just a mess. I was just drinking and insulting everyone and having and getting... in fact, by then, you know what happened then in terms of my kind of well-being or not well-being was that in the 70s, there was still... You could still have maybe the illusion that maybe it would start again, maybe the 60s, as it were, would start again. And the one thing that maybe... that made some of us think so was the punk explosion. As nihilist as it was. I mean, if people would go... There would be shows, and then people would jump into cars and drive up to, like, the Fairmont, the Pacific Heights, get out of the cars with chains and bars, and just smash these fucking BMWs, and just break the windows out, and just fucking, just wreck everything we could, jump back in the cars, and get back downtown, you know, before the cops all started showing up.
And did, from what you were seeing, did punk kind of... Was it an export from England? Was it spontaneously?
Oh, yeah.
It was really
definitely.
The ideas and the culture were coming from England.
Oh, definitely. Really. I can almost remember the day when the Sex Pistols hit.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine drove up on the sidewalk and demanded that this record store open. It was closed. And started to break down the door. Because he had to have Nevermind the Bollocks, you know, their only album.
Yeah.
And brought it back. We played it like 1,000 times in a row, you know. Whoa, fuck. The energy is back, you know. Wow, maybe we can go to town again. And then everybody started ODing, and I was still drinking as heavily as ever. I mean, it just crashed almost immediately, especially in San Francisco. It was horrible. I mean, the casualties. And these were kids that were already too young to have been in the 60s.
Yeah.
And you had this crazy, funny deal where you'd have all these leftist groups that immediately would come to where all the punks were hanging out. It was just great. It was so hilarious.
They saw that this was where, where was that?
We got to get them, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And
sure,
they'd buy them food, and then they'd say, fuck off. You know, they had there was no chance that they were going to fall
into
that.
Thanks for your food. Take your ideology and shove it.
Exactly. It was just hilarious. And we'd just sit there laughing, you know. And so they were mad at us and wanted to break out, you know. It was great.
That's great.
Classic Russian revolution.
But the drinking and the dope was just really, it just was...
Were punks at that time also as, in terms of the drugs, were they as self-destructive and chaotic as some punks were later on, or are
it
still?
It seemed to me,
it became
certainly
that way.
San Francisco,
yeah.
The best kids I knew were dead in like 6 months.
Shit.
It was amazing.
And this was what, heroin mostly, or alcohol and
heroin.
Other things? Wow. Wow.
Yeah, it was really something. So it had a lot of anger
Yeah.
And in San Francisco, especially, you know, the anti-hippie thing of this of the punkers.
Yeah.
Well, there was that was San Francisco. You know, there, that was the hate and everything. There was like two worlds, put it mildly, two different, you know, universes or something.
So you yourself never really flirted much or had a great deal of sympathy with hippies or hippie culture?
Oh, I was kind of a hippie. Yeah, I was kind of a Marxist hippie. You know,
okay,
Back, I lived in the hate, you know, I lived in the hate in 66, 67. And, you know, but a lot of people went through all these changes. I mean, we all went through all these changes.
Sure.
Like my friend Joe came back from Vietnam. He was on Point in the Jungle, two tours. You know, he was combat. He was LERPs. He was these people behind the line. He was a Catholic, kill the commies kind of thing. He came back to San Francisco, and he lived there, and right next to the hate, actually. His family lived there. They were fishermen, Italians, and whatnot. And then he became a total hippie, a total pacifist. And then within a year, he was arming the SLA. He was in Vince Ramos and these groups. That when the thing had collapsed.
So there was this immense promiscuity, and hippie was too amorphous to really. I mean, it wasn't a political movement, you know.
Oh,
necessarily. No. It was just a
cultural, definition, hippie means passive and whatever, dude, right. And all that shit, you know. Yeah. Do nothing. Just sit on your ass and burn a candle or something.
Yeah.
That bugged me at the time. I was not a hippie in that sense.
Yeah. But in a lifestyle way, in terms of mellowness, the drugs.
Oh, taking a lot of LSD and everything. Yeah, sure.
Not
that was great. But not, you know. And that was another thing that happened. And I lived there until, I remember the Easter holiday of 67. The city hall had decided to move the city buses to the two parallel streets to Haight Street. So that more tourists could come, so it could be even more overrun by commercial shit. And there were some of us who wanted to block the buses and get out there. I think it was Easter itself when they changed it. And there were like six people that showed up. And there were hundreds and hundreds of square blocks, thousands of hippies. And they were too fucking passive to defend their own turf, you know. You know, it was bullshit. It was just so weak.
So even at that stage, it was very clear that there was going to be a commercial colonizing of this movement. They were vamping on it. They saw energy there that
could
be neutralized and channeled. Yeah. So even at that early stage,
it had become
part of popular commercial culture.
It was people in these tour buses just taking pictures of the hippies. Look at the hippies.
Yeah.
And that's what we said when we first got there from Stanford. We drove in and we were going, hippies, because we were digging it. Wow, hippies. Or beatniks. We called them beatniks for a very brief. They weren't no longer beatniks. They were the next part of that thing. It was great. We loved it. But just the passivity, you know, the quiescence, you know, and the, you know, what do you do when a pig comes up to you and fucks with you? Just go home or some shit like that? I mean, come on. But that's what they did, you know. It's just they were worthless.
So what started changing at this stage? You were drinking, you were kind of, you were after the situationist. What were you doing then?
Well, I ended up moving back to Oregon.
Yeah.
Things were so bad in
when?
The Bay Area. This was 81.
81.
Beginning of 81.
Yeah.
And I got there on the day that Reagan was shot. As a matter of fact, I did one of those drive-away cars. I mean, this woman I was with, we didn't have anything anyway, but we just, you know, it's easy to move that way.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went to the bus station, and I remember there was this black guy with this little tiny portable TV, and he was laughing, and there was this crowd around him, and, you know, we went over like, what's up, you know? Now Reagan's been shot in Washington. He'd only been in office like 3 months. This is the beginning of 81, early spring of 81. Anyway, and I thought, what a difference it was in 63 when Kennedy was killed, President Kennedy was killed. There were a lot of people just cutting up. And people right then thought he was probably dead. I mean, he wasn't hardly that injured, you know, unfortunately.
No.
But they were all just kind of laughing, like, ah, that's great, you know. So even though nothing was happening, at least there was the dominant shit had eroded a lot, you know.
So,
but the whole 80s was just awful. There was nothing going on. Absolutely nothing.
What were you doing in the 80s? You were in incubation? You were developing ideas?
Well, I was writing, but there was no...
There was no journals that you were involved in? Still Fifth Estate?
Fifth Estate. That was, although everything they published would be accompanied by two or three attacks, you know, so that wasn't so totally fun either, you know, you had to blast everything.
And when was Anarchy born at Yoda?
Well, that was out of Fifth Estate. Yeah. It was kind of a spin-off of Fifth Estate. And it's funny, Jason always, for a long time, had this inferiority complex. Oh, Fifth Estate.
Was Jason also involved in Fifth Estate or not?
Okay. No, he lived in Missouri. He wasn't physically very close to Detroit either. But and that got better and better. Mm-hmm. And then, and another big ray of light for me was Demolition Derby. The two issues. There were only two issues,
remarkable.
But that was... Yeah, that was great. This was anti-civ. This is already something, you know.
And what were then Michael's influences? That was based in Montreal, or did he have an international collaboration?
I think he just put that out. That was it. And never met him until now.
Yeah. So he was working on this stuff in parallel. What were his influences at that point? I guess he knew about Freddie at that stage.
I guess. Yeah. I don't even know. But the other thing, there was something happening with Earth First. That was the thing, especially out west, that was happening. You know, the monkey wrenching, and you know that had some aspects, some fucked up aspects, that's for sure. But you know, that was something going on, I guess.
And they were more active in the Pacific Northwest at that stage. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
So
in Eugene, you had the more Forest Defender Earth First types, and then you had the urban punker anarchist types, and to some degree that started connecting in the 90s. And when the Unabomber thing happened in the mid-90s, 95, it was huge, and I discovered that all these kids were way behind Ted. They were all pro Ted, and I thought to myself, something is changing here. Something is awakening here. Fuck, you know, I didn't have any idea. You know, they were the punks. That's great. You know, they despise a lot of things, but you know, I don't know. And and they hated the left quite a lot. And then things started cooking in Eugene. And then there was that riot in '99. You know, so things kind of came.
GA
back to
was
life.
Born when?
GA?
Yeah.
2000, I think it was. And the first four issues were one of the Green Anarchist from England.
Yeah, Green Anarchist
kid,
magazine.
Saxon Woods.
Right,
he was in prison for a while with that. Okay. Then he came over here and he jumped into Earth First. He was never never anti-civ at all. Yep. And he moved away. He and his partner moved and handed it over. And I wasn't really a part of it. I was aware of...
In England, was he involved with... With Green Anarchist?
Yeah.
He was.
But he was a kid. I mean, he was mostly selling the paper. I don't think he was...
Did Green Anarchist was happening in parallel and at the same time? I don't even know if it's still going on.
Well, it probably isn't.
No.
I mean, I saw Paul last year. And
Paul?
He was kind of like a real key figure in there. He's pretty depressed.
Okay.
Yeah, things just come and go, you know.
Sure.
It moves on and takes other forms and everything.
That's right, yeah. They have their life cycles.
Maybe it's not dead, though. I don't know.
Good. So you're... The five, I think four or five principal essays on time, on language, those were written at what stage? Or when did...
Mid-80s, like 80s.
Was that a very productive period then? That was the time when all these ideas of yours were coalescing.
Well, I guess so. I mean, and if there's nothing to do, you can write.
Yeah.
You know, you can explore, you can... And I was doing this, you know. I didn't want to do anything else, so I lived just on the margin. And all my time, I'd be in the library 7 days a week sometimes, just browsing around and, you know, just that's what I did, besides drinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't fuck all to connect with. There were these idiot peace creeps that were just beneath contempt. Yeah. And there were two of us that put out posters ridiculing things in Eugene. And, you know, some people liked those a lot. That was the only kind of active thing, though.
I'm just wondering, other currents that are anarchist and ecologist, the other game in town is social ecology. Murray Bookchin at the time. was certainly active, 70s, 80s.
Yeah.
You had heard of him. Was there any intersection or usefulness that you saw in that? Nothing that you
Well, in the 60s, yeah. I was more, I thought, listen, anarchists and post-scarcity anarchists were fine because they didn't have any critique of that it doesn't depend on production.
Yeah.
Production is the thing that kills this, and it doesn't lead to anarchy. You know?
Yeah.
But I didn't. But there was really no... once again, it's the difference between the West Coast and the East Coast. I really wasn't much aware of that. And then when I became aware of it, I was already, you know, already had implicitly a critique of that, you know, that he did, that he wasn't anti-Civ and he wasn't anti-industrial.
He wasn't, no, of course, he never was.
He never was.
No. Uh-huh. I think that post, post-scarcity anarchism was certainly an interesting direction that he took for a while there. But there again, its conclusions are what? You know, that there's going to be these factories for you.
Well, exactly.
Gotten over the scarcity issue.
Now that we have enough production, now we can have anarchy. I mean, that's just the other way around to look at it. It's the opposite. Yeah. Now that everybody's
industrialized. But in and of itself, it turned the tables on certain ideas of, you know, constant struggle and scarcity and poverty.
I'm sure.
It turned the tables on that at that stage.
You know that well. I don't know.
No, I read his stuff. Before I read your stuff, of course. So 15 years ago, I'd read Bookchin's stuff, and then 10 years ago, I'd read your stuff.
But it's funny, once again, that gulf.
Yeah.
I mean, Bob Black writes all this stuff about Murray Bookchin, you know, social ecology. So many people in the West Coast say, and he's got two more books that he wants Jason to publish. And everybody says, why on earth would you pay any more attention to this? And I said,
flogging a dead horse, literally, at this stage.
But it's not totally dead.
It isn't. No, it isn't dead at all. No.
Maybe it is in the gene or something. But
I think it's taken on some pretty pernicious forms in many ways, actually. If it's settled into libertarian municipalism, that's more pernicious than even when he was alive and hadn't developed towards that. I don't know.
Sure.
I don't know what Janet Beale's doing today.
Well, it declined, and then he ends up a Leninist. That's not even a huge surprise.
Yeah.
And speaking of that, you know, the second time I was in Turkey, the Yeşil Anarşi people, the Green Anarchy kids there, said that now the party line is social ecology. Did I tell you that?
You didn't, no.
I thought it was a joke. And they showed me these pictures of a PKK march, you know, like ETA, another Marxist-Leninist thing.
Yeah.
You know? And social ecology is our... something, I forget. They
were That's incredible.
Yeah, because the main guy who's been in prison for a long time, and they would have hung him years ago, except Turkey wants to not quite do so much torture and hanging people because they want to get into the EU, you know.
Wow.
So this guy would be a corpse, you know, ages ago. Well, he got a hold of some Bookchin and changed the party line because that's the way those groups work. And instantly they're Murray Bookchin fans. And I thought, sure, what a joke, that's very funny. And no joke, here's the photos of the thing. You know,
the closest parallel I can think to that was in the early 90s here, late 80s even. No, early 90s. I don't know what they were doing in the late 80s. There was a class war type anarchist publication called Démonarchie Montreal. And part of their platform, if you want to call it that, I guess they had it. They weren't platformists, but they had, you know, points about what, you know, unifies them. And they threw in social ecology. And at that time, I was more ecologist than I was class war, and yet I still consider myself an anarcho-communist. And I remember, you know, thinking with other people, you know, what do they mean by that? You know, it's like, how much of Bookchin have they read? They read enough to realize it's not in contradiction with their type of anarchism, so they threw it in just to green things, or I don't know. I don't think it was opportunistic in the sense they were trying to draw people. They weren't organizations that tried to rope people in. They were very much affinity group in terms of their functioning. They were very quiet. So I don't think they were doing it to draw people in. They were probably doing it to try to, you know, have more coherence in terms of the various currents out there, I suspect. But it reminds me of that people like pull this stuff in and say, hey, this sounds good, and it's probably not in contradiction with what I think. And Bookchin really isn't in contradiction with a lot of anarcho-communism or even platformism, I would say. Mesh in many ways.
Things.
Yeah,
I see.
I would say.
Yeah, we never really had anarcho-communists out there, more a few syndicalists.
Yeah.
Do you know what time it is?
It's just after, it's 11:15. We better start heading.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. we could either continue this
by email in,
or on, are you guys want to go on your own? Do you have enough room to take me, or should we say goodbye here?
Well, I can come. You want to continue in the car?
I don't know if you want to.
Oh, if you want.
I don't know if there's more to say. There's probably lots more to say.
We always
gap.
Always talk by the hour.
Close now.
Yeah.
That's great. That's
yeah.
Great.